The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, political junkies, and welcome to this special post-midterms podcast and this week's Reporters Roundtable on the Bill Press Pod. Well, you know, even old-timers like me and David Jackson have to admit, we've never seen an election quite like this one. The pollsters got it wrong, the media got it wrong, the Republicans got it wrong, everybody got it wrong, except the voters. The first big surprise, of course, there was no big red wave, maybe just a big red ripple. The second big surprise, here on this Friday morning, 4 days later, we still don't know for sure which party is going to control the House or the Senate. And that rumbling you hear? No, it's not Republicans urging Donald Trump to hurry up and announce for 2024. Au contraire, it's Republicans blaming him for their midterm debacle, urging Donald Trump to get the hell out of the way. So we ask today's panel, what happened? What's it all mean? And where do we go from here? Joining us today, David Jackson, national political correspondent for USA Today. David, welcome back.
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
And Jessica Taylor, senator and governor's editor for the Great Cook Political Report. Hello, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you both here. Now, I want to read a couple of headlines. In the last couple of weeks before the election, this is October 19, New York Times, headline, Democrats feared Red October has arrived. October 25, Democrats brace for red wave in House. On CNN, October 26, why the midterms are going to be great for Donald Trump. So, obviously, that's not exactly what happened. I just like your take from the 30,000-foot level. Jessica, what the hell happened?
This really was not a traditional midterm. And, you know, we saw signs early on that it may buck the trend. But, I mean, that article was sort of what I was hearing from people. I mean, Democrats were optimistic. I think the tide clearly turned over the summer with the Dobbs decision. And that energized Democratic voters in a new way. And Republicans really had such problematic candidates, especially in these Senate races. And you had Democrats that were running much better campaigns. But then you look at the fundamentals that were still there, 40-year high inflation, President Biden's approval ratings sinking. You know, in August and September, I looked at the president's approval ratings in the battleground states, and he was above 40, narrowly in some of the places. But then I looked at them again the week before the election, and in places like Arizona, Pennsylvania, he was in the mid to high 30s. And that's just danger territory. We typically don't see that candidates can run that far ahead of a president's approval ratings in midterms, but it happened. Mm-hmm. And I just think this was... it was one I think we're going to be dissecting for a while because, again, it did not follow any of the traditional midterm ways that we have seen. And, you know, Democrats I was talking to even the week before, one wished to me that the election had been held a month ago. they're like, I think we would have won them, but we've seen this deterioration. And then I was texting with one pollster a couple of days before the election, just asking him how the environment looked. And he just simply texted back a poop emoji. So Democrats were not expecting this, I don't think. And certainly the public polls, at least some Democratic polls were more rosy, but even the fundamentals underneath those had people skeptical.
So, David, how did the media miss all of this? I mean, you know,
hey, we can only deal with the information presented to us. I think it's for the reasons Jessica said. I mean, the polls didn't show a clear Republican victory, in my view, but they did in the last couple of weeks. They showed clear momentum toward the Republicans, and the the environment was very favorable to Republicans, and the numbers were going up. So people figured that that would play on out and they would have a good election day. Well, they didn't. But a couple of things. My explanation is very simplified. I think it's all boiled down to Donald Trump. I think the Donald Trumpified Republican Party just can't forge a national majority. Just can't do it. This is four elections in a row where they haven't done it. Even Trump himself, you know, famously lost the popular vote in 2016. So, and I think it manifests itself in several ways. But most specifically, bad candidates. I mean, Mehmet Oz was a terrible candidate in Pennsylvania. Herschel Walker, terrible candidate. Blake Masters, Arizona, terrible candidate. And those were all Trump candidates, and they manifested his worst instincts, and they weren't able to win what should have been very winnable races. I know that abortion has also played a very big factor as well, and I'm eager to look at the numbers and try to suss out exactly how that played out. But even abortion, if you think about it, is a Trump issue, because Trump judges were the ones who solidified the Dobbs majority. So I think it's just as simple as the fact that this was a spectacular environment for Republicans. It was as good an environment as they had in 1994 and in 2010, but they weren't able to do anything this year, and I think it all boils down to Donald Trump.
Right. I agree with David on that. I mean, echoing what he said, it's Republicans kind of snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. And a midterm election is supposed to be a referendum on the current president. But we have never had a former president that has inserted himself this much into an election. Typically, presidents go off, they start foundations, they travel the country, they travel the world. You know, if you're Jimmy Carter, you're building Habitat houses, like, they involve themselves in politics some, but not to the extent that Trump has, and not to the extent that he backed these candidates and in almost all cases backed the worst candidate possible and sort of left Republicans with these very weak candidates. And, you know, again, he was traveling over the summer. He was injected back into the politics and into public consciousness. And what David said about the abortion issue and judges is right on as well, but he kind of disappeared. But this last week or so, he was back on the trail, and he's teasing a midterm, I mean, a 2024 endorsement. And for a lot of people, you know, I watched a lot of focus groups this cycle, and I was looking up voters that had voted for Trump in 2016, but voted for Biden in 2020. And they were, one thing I heard that was consistent is that they don't want Trump to run and they don't want Biden to run. But with Trump, especially if there were candidates of his that they had backed, they became far more skeptical of that.
Yeah. So since you both jumped to Donald Trump, let's go there. We know that, no, exactly, and I totally agree with you. Let's go to the former president. He gave a now famous interview the day before the election, on election eve, to News Nation about what his attitude would be if the Republicans won or lost. Here's the former president.
Well, I think if they win, I should get all the credit. And if they lose, I should not be blamed at all. Okay. When they win, I think they're going to do very well. I'll probably be given very little credit, even though in many cases I told people to run and they ran and they turned out to be very good candidates.
So, David, that's not exactly what people are saying today, right?
There it is. I mean, that's just Trump. All the, you know, things go well, I deserve all the credit. If they don't do well, I deserve none of the blame. That's him. That's the way he feels about it. But I think it was more the latter than the former. And I think he's responsible for the Republicans' poor showing, though. He'll never acknowledge it. And a lot of his supporters will never acknowledge it either.
Well, but I've been surprised how many people, Republicans, still maybe not Mitch McConnell, not Kevin McCarthy, but some big names have been willing to come out and point the finger right at him. Jessica, here's a couple. I want to play back to back, Jay, if we can. Winsome Sears, who's the Republican Lieutenant Governor of Virginia first, and then Senator Toomey from Pennsylvania.
The voters have spoken, and they have said that they want a different leader. And a true leader understands when they have become a liability.
President Trump had to insert himself, and that changed the nature of the race, and that created just too much of an obstacle. And by the way, it's not just Pennsylvania. Look, all over the country,
yes,
there's a very high correlation between MAGA candidates and big losses.
So, Jessica, how does this set the stage for Donald Trump's, at least we expect, announcement to run for 2024 next week?
Right. Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Mar-a-Lago. I mean, it's like the least suspenseful thing ever. But, you know, I was seeing some of these people, some Pat Toomey, I'm not that surprised by him saying that. He was never like a super Trumpy guy. And here's the ironic thing, that the way that Trump has changed the party, it forced a lot of people, I think, to look at and say, do I want to be a part of this conference anymore? Someone like Pat Toomey, that I think if he had run, this seat probably wouldn't have been competitive and Republicans would have held it. The same thing in Ohio with Rob Portman. Now, J.D. Vance ended up hanging on there, but he had to be bailed out with millions and millions of dollars from McConnell's super PAC, the Senate Leadership Fund. The Winsome Sears one surprised me a little bit yesterday. She's someone that ran on a very Trumpy platform, was very involved. She's African-American woman, was involved in African Americans for Trump, and in Virginia there. And so she surprised me a bit. But again, I always just feel like, yes, and I was feeling this, you know, as I got back to my house around like 3:30 a.m., I think, on election night, and looking at all of this and thinking, okay, any Republican that looks at this should be able to say, we blew this, essentially, and it was because of Trump and the Trump-backed candidates. But in the same way that you had people start to rebuke him after January 6th, which, I mean, there's no comparison to what happened on January 6th in the election, right. Let me clarify, but it just sort of the rebukes that he got, and then they backed away from that. And does that happen, though? That's the question to me.
Well, yeah. What do you think about that, David? I mean, we've seen these decision points before, right?
Right.
Where a lot of us said, well, this is it for Donald Trump, right? I mean, going back to when he slammed and slurred John McCain, right, in the primary.
Right.
Oh,
the
that's
very
it.
Start of the campaign, survived that. Yeah.
And certainly, as Jessica points out, after the second impeachment, January 6th, Republicans have to impeach him this time, right? And they had a chance, and they didn't. So there's no guarantee that they, even after this, that they'll dump Trump, is it?
That's right. And it's funny you should say that. Our old friend Maggie Haberman just tweeted, Trump is more vulnerable than he's been in a long time, but that has happened before and he survived.
There you go.
That's certainly true. And you made a good point, Bill. A lot of Republican office holders and people we know, the Pat Toomeys of the world and such, are coming out against Trump on the record. They've been talking about him on background for quite some time. When I talk about the Trump, I'm talking about the Trump base, the people who show up to his rallies and people who vote and the rank and file Republicans. The real question is how they feel about this and if they're going to stick with Trump or if they're going to look around. Now, I've talked to many people who've conducted focus groups, and in those sessions, Republican voters said, hey, yeah, we'd like to check out some alternatives. And Ron DeSantis is getting a very good look-see as we speak. But the question is, do people actually move forward and work against Trump? That's going to be the question. And there's no way to answer that right now.
I want to go back to some of the issues both of you mentioned. Nate Cohn, front page of the New York Times today, headline, Election Denial and End of Row Shaped the Results. Democracy and abortion. Jessica, what are you finding that really drove people out to vote?
I mean, we are seeing an uptick in younger voters. That's one thing that's notable. And listen, I think we still have to parse some of these results, but I mean, clearly that was a motivating issue. Even in some of the polling, we were seeing these democracy issues. I think in the final NBC poll, it was pretty high there. I just continue to think, again, you know, as election analysts, we have to look at fundamentals and we have to look at history. And the most recent midterm elections have all followed that history. 2018, Trump loses the House. 2014, Obama loses the Senate. 2010, Obama loses the House. 2006, Bush loses the House.
Right.
I mean, these follow a pattern. And again, it has to be some major event that changes it like it did in 2002 when we were sort of still in the post 9/11 rally around the flag effect and Republicans did not suffer there at the polls, if they gained seats. But was this perhaps a turning point of 50 years of rolling back rights that was akin to that perhaps? And you have democracy so unstable, it feels like at times, and with people on the ballot that were just complete election deniers in the face of facts. I mean, I will say it looks like we're still waiting, of course, on the outcome in in Arizona there with Carrie Lake, who's been one of the top election deniers. But across the board, some of these people lost governorships, and certainly Pennsylvania, Doug Mastriano got crushed there, and Michigan, Tudor Dixon, and Wisconsin, Tim Michaels. And it also looks like many of these Secretary of States that also ran on election denialism will not end up winning. And that's good news for, I mean that really reshapes what happens in 2024. And Trump, if he wins, and if he wins the nomination, and if he is the general election candidate, he's not going to have people in these places like he hoped he would, that would sort of bend to his will. You know, the Republican Party, clearly he is. DeSantis had the best night of any Republican, hands down.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I think Trump might have been able to spend the losses a little better across the country had Ron DeSantis not just completely crushed in his reelection bid. And so he's now the hot new thing. I mean, he was sending out a long missive yesterday to reporters, you know, mocking Ron DeSantis. And I mean, it just read, it was like, yeah, you're not yeah. mess with him at all. You know, that you, why would you put out this, you know, 500 word statement if you're not worried about him at all or different things? Here's the thing I look at, though. If we start the presidential primary cycle, because Republican primaries are winner take all, this is how Trump got the nomination in the first place. If they were proportional like Democrats, I don't think he would have been nominated. But if he's still, I still think he has like a floor there with his loyal supporters. And can DeSantis sort of get everybody else? That's the question. And who else gets in? You know, other Trump, you know, deniers that would be very different even from DeSantis, like, you know, a Chris Sununu or Larry Hogan or something. So it's the difference in how the primaries are run. And that's one that benefits a candidate like Trump.
Right. Okay. Before we get too far down the road on 2024 and potential Republican or Democratic nominees, I want to come back to again what were the determining factors in this vote, which we're still trying to understand and will be for a long time. David, I want to play for you. I think the person who might have summed up exactly what happened the best and explained what happened and why is, believe it or not, Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Here he is.
Look, why do the Democrats do better than expected? Because for 2 years, they've governed as liberals. They've governed as whacked out lefty nut jobs. And you know what that did? That excited their base. That excited a bunch of young voters that came out in massive numbers, because when you actually stand for something, your base gets excited.
What do you think, David? I mean, young people did come out, as Jessica pointed out, in record numbers. So did women. And it looks like abortion, environment. Have you talked that Maxwell Frost, the Gen Z, who got elected in Florida, right. On the gun
replace
issue?
Replace Val Deming, yes. Replace Val Deming. Yeah. Well, you know, you should listen to Ted, Bill. He has some good things to say every now and then. No, I think he certainly, as far as it goes, I think he's right about that part. The Democratic base was obviously very excited, but I still think, with all due respect to Nate Cohn, I think election denialism was an overrated issue. It's uh-huh. Trump. It's Trump, and not only Trump, but the Trump style, because a lot of these candidates were just, let's face it, a lot of these candidates were just weird or bad. I mean, Doug Mastriano, I mean, anybody who saw him on the stump is going to look at him and say, this is a guy who's running for governor. I just think, you know, several hundred thousand people in Pennsylvania did that and voted accordingly. Blake Masters was a very unusual candidate. Herschel Walker was probably the least qualified Senate candidate I've ever seen. So it's just, I just can't help it. I hate to keep repeating myself, but it just all boils down to Trump and the Trump style. And also, he, in response to Ted Cruz's analysis, I would argue that Trump and Cruz, for that matter, have dragged the Republican Party too far to the right, you know, right wing wackos. I think that's a bigger problem. And that was a bigger influence on this particular election.
And certainly, Jessica, I think Lindsey Graham's call for a national ban on abortion didn't necessarily prove as a winner for Republicans.
It did not. I had talked with a lot of senators about that. And, you know, they were privately very much cringing. And remember the day that he announced it, there was actually really bad inflation news right as the White House and Biden were getting ready to sign the Inflation Reduction Act. So Republicans could have had this news cycle that turned it back to the economy again. But then Graham introduced this bill and that's all the news is about. He completely steps on it. And, you know, especially because, okay, the decision came down end of June and sort of what the Republican message, which wasn't very, you know, rehearsed or coherent really at all. They really struggled. You think after the leak, after the decision leak, they would have had sort of been more ready for a response, but was, look, this should be a state issue. It's going to be sent back to the states. But now you have Graham doing this. And, you know, Republicans that are running in states like Nevada, Oregon, they sort of thought that this issue of abortion was going to be off the table because their states had already codified it into law. But if this 15-week abortion ban passes, it supersedes that. So suddenly you're looking at it differently. And it's just not the conversation that that many candidates and campaigns were wanting to have. And I mean, it was a major, I think, error by Graham, and not one that won him any plaudits within the Republican caucus. Yeah. I mean, but I think back to, you know, the Graham pre-Trump, you know, what he said, before he became a Trump acolyte, it was, we're going to nominate Donald Trump and we're going to get killed. And they've lost the House. They lost the House when he was there. They may win it back, but very narrowly, not by what they thought. And they lost the Senate. And I don't think it looks like they're going to win the Senate back this year. Though it was clearly there for the taking.
So they still have some more outstanding Senate and House races. We'll get to that right after the break. But before we take a break, I just want to take a moment to get both of your thoughts on what this movie talks so much about the former president, what this all means for the current president. I saw a note this morning on one of the newsletters, many I read every morning, that called Joe Biden the most underestimated president in modern times. David, nobody seems to want to give him credit, and yet he defied the odds in this case. Don't you think he's got to get some credit?
Oh, yeah, for sure. He deserves a lot of credit. He's getting some negative credit. You know, earlier this week, we were all wondering which Democrats were going to come out and tell him not to run if things went bad on Tuesday. Well, those voices are totally silent right now and celebrating their success. I think it puts Biden in a much better political position. He and his top aides have insisted all along he's going to run in 2024 and show us we don't know what we're talking about. Well, he feels even stronger about that today. So barring some kind of health issue, I think he's going to run. He's going to be nominated, and we'll see who he runs against with the Republicans.
How do you rate his standing today after post-midterms, Jessica?
I mean, again, like David said, I think he's better off than he was, certainly. But are there still problems? Are there still cracks there? I think there is. I mean, Biden is just – the problem is, I think a lot of people that voted for Biden voted for him as a transition president. And whether that's going to happen – again, what I have heard echoed in every focus group I've watched is that no one wants a retrench of Biden versus Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's clearly questions about his health and his age and different things. I mean, I'm not with the people who, you know, think that he's suffering from dementia or anything, but because I think if you follow Biden for any amount of time, you know that he just has verbal gaffes. That's just Biden, and different things. But, you know, it could give him a, I don't know. I just think that there is still a push for a generational shift within the Democratic Party. And we saw a lot of people win those types of races that could be future candidates of the Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania, the governor-elect, I think is going to be a rising star. Wes Moore in Maryland. I mean, Gretchen Whitmer is still there after a win and different things. So it's just how impatient could people get of wanting to have sort of new blood?
I just have to point out, every time somebody tells me or mentions Joe Biden's age to me, he will be 80 next year. Republicans
this
in
month,
Iowa.
He'll be 80 this he'll be oh, 80 this, on November
no,
20th.
I'm sorry. This month. Right. This month. Thank you. Thank you, David.
Sorry about that.
No. I meant to say next. Anyhow. Yes, you're right. But Republicans in Iowa just reelected Chuck Grassley, who is, 89. All right. Yes. So I guess it's all relative. Here we go. We're going to come back and take a look at what is still outstanding with Jessica Taylor and David Jackson. Jessica Taylor from the Cook Political Report, of course, and David Jackson from USA Today. Here on today's roundtable, we'll be right back. And today's roundtable is brought to you by the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA, as they call themselves. Over half a million strong, the good men and women of the Laborers Union under the leadership of President Terry O'Sullivan, who will be stepping down as longtime president of the Laborers at the end of the year. The Laborers Union, very active in construction, of course. That's their main effort, rebuilding America's infrastructure. Active in the energy field as well, building those old-fashioned pipelines as well as new solar panels and wind turbines, and also many members active in the healthcare industry. The Laborers Union, check out their website at liuna.org. We thank them for their great work building America. Thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back with today's roundtable here on the Bill Press Pod. Again, joining us, national political correspondent for USA Today, David Jackson, senator and governor's editor at the Cook Political Report, Jessica Taylor, and now joined also by Alex Seitzwald, senior digital politics reporter for NBC News. Welcome back to all of you. As we speak, the House is undecided but leaning Republican. The Senate, still undecided with outstanding races in Arizona and Nevada yet to be decided, and the runoff in Georgia on December 6th. Okay, Jessica, as the senator editor for Cook Political Report, why don't you just break the suspense and tell us who's going to win Arizona and Nevada and Georgia while you're at it.
Well, here's who I think has the best chance at this point. I spent a lot of time yesterday talking to people, and especially in Arizona and Nevada, about what is still outstanding. There were some new votes that came in last night. I know in Arizona, Kelly is still up, I think, ahead of where he needs to be. And some of these votes that are going to come in are is going to narrow the race. That particularly some of these, when I was talking with some Democrats there in the state, they saw that later early voting tended to vote more Republican. There's some election day day of voting that is still out there, but particularly people who dropped off their ballots in person on election day, and that has trended more Republican. But with what we believe is outstanding, it is not enough to sort of narrow Kelly's lead enough and to allow Masters to come back. Now, he is still saying that is a possibility. But again, many sources I've talked to, this is where they think that is, you know, so that race has not been called yet by the AP. We will wait for that.
But let me stop you right there. Just so David, do you agree? Arizona looks like Mark Kelly holds on.
For sure. That's definitely what I'm hearing. And Masto looks like it has a good chance in Nevada. The Republicans aren't optimistic about either race.
Uh-huh. Alex, what's your call on Arizona?
I would agree that I would much rather be Kelly right now than Masters.
Yeah. All right. Jessica, David mentioned Nevada. How about Nevada? Where there are 95,000 votes still to be counted or so?
Yeah, we're still trying to figure that's the thing. You're still trying to figure out exactly how many and if mail-in votes, if they can come in after Election Day, depending upon, you know, when they are postmarked by. So Adam Laxalt, the Republican there, is still leading Catherine Cortez Masto. However, when you look at where the outstanding vote still is, it's in Clark. It's particularly in Washoe, which are the two biggest swing counties. And if you look at John Ralston, the Nevada Independent, longtime political guru there in the state, he's who I look to for certainly guidance on a lot of these things. No one knows the state better. You know, of the vote, he tweeted last night that she needs to be winning, you know, between six. She had been winning 65. That went down a little bit, but it was still above 60. She could even get down to 55% of what's coming in and still win. So I expect to see if more numbers come out today, hopefully, that we could see. I just hope there are more numbers to clarify that, not who wins, but that she could leapfrog Laxalt in that regard. So again, I think both of those are going to go Democratic. And that means then that the Georgia runoff is not for control of the Senate. Control of the Senate, if Democrats win those two seats, is assured to be at least a 50-50 majority.
Right. David, you're from South Carolina, right next door to Georgia. What do you hear? What do you read? And do you agree that Warnock has the advantage in the runoff?
Without question. I think both parties will tell you they feel like Warnock has the advantage because there was a definite lack of Republican enthusiasm for Walker. He ran well behind Brian Kemp, the winning governor's candidate. You won't have Kemp on the ballot in the runoff. So there's a lot of questions as to how enthusiastic the GOP will be about Walker in a runoff. So there's no question that Warnock's the favorite. And that's all there is to it. So there's not a lot of optimism among Republicans about these outstanding races.
So, Alex, looking at Georgia with this runoff, again, it may not determine control of the Senate, but it will give certainly the Democrats an edge if they were 51 instead of 50. The big question I hear about Georgia is, do they want Donald Trump to come in and campaign for Herschel Walker? How do you see it, Alex?
I think they would, at this point, I think you have to assume that Trump is more of a help to Democrats than he is to Republicans after the results Tuesday, where not only did Republicans underperform, but specifically the candidates most closely associated with Trump underperformed relative to other Republicans. I think for the challenge for both parties, but for Democrats too, is going to be getting their voters to turn out again, you know, after having just voted in November. And without the control of the Senate on the line, the stakes are going to seem a lot lower. So having Trump come in, that would get a lot of attention. It would, you know, motivate the base. And I think at this point, it looks like Trump is more of a motivator to the Democratic base than he is to the Republican one.
Can they keep him out?
can anybody stop Trump from doing anything? And does Herschel Walker want him there? I mean, I think that's also the good question. I don't know that we can assume that Herschel Walker has the most the best political acumen at this point. So he might want him there. And you know, yeah, I think Trump might just not be able to resist the chance to go down there because he's now got to shore up his own 2024 chances, and he was eyeing an announcement, you know, days from now. So I think he's going to want to put himself in front of a camera as much as possible, I would guess.
Right. David, I want to come back to you because you're here in Washington. Let's take a look at the House. I think it's just the most amazing of all that, again, on this Friday morning, we have an idea, but we still don't know for sure which party will control the House. And Kevin McCarthy predicted they would pick up 60 seats, right? Ain't going to be anywhere close, David.
No, not even close. And it was foolish of McCarthy and other Republicans to make those kind of predictions. You know, people forget 2 years ago they picked up 14 House seats. People forget that. So there weren't that many more seats to get in the first place. But it was obvious that it was not going to be 50-60. It was obvious it's been obvious for months that they weren't going to have a 2010 type of year. Having said that, I'm surprised at how poorly they've done. I mean, they could be as low as 220. In the end, and that is something they didn't expect. And I think it actually endangers McCarthy's chances to be Speaker of the House. I mean, that could be a real mess if enough far-right members don't want McCarthy after all this. So it's not going to be a very pleasant experience for the House Republicans, even if they hold on to the majority.
Yeah, Jessica, David's right. There are several members already, including the chair of the Freedom Caucus, right, who say, let's not so fast, right? Let's slow things down. Let's not rush into making McCarthy Speaker. But even if he becomes Speaker, he's going to be really beholden to the Freedom Caucus, I guess, is going to be pulling the strings. It looks that way, correct? How do you see it?
They've made headaches for every most recent past Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner and Paul Ryan. So, you know, McCarthy's more... I think they have a better relationship with him, but nothing is assured. And, you know, one of the things I'm looking at, even the down ballot leadership, you have Tom Emmer, who led the NRCC angling for whip. And, you know, there was Jonathan Martin, now back at Politico, reported yesterday, too, that Rick Scott, who led the NRSC, had quite a few tiffs with McConnell over how they were running that, certainly. Had been readying a video, had been already taped a video to challenge McConnell for House leader or Senate leader, rather. And, you know, you actually have to win in order to make the case that you should have a better leadership position. Like, Republicans fell short of their stated goal to flip the Senate. That's what it looks like now, unless we see something change in these Arizona and Nevada races. And based on the projections, just a single digit victory is also not going to give McCarthy a lot of leeway. If you have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, Lauren Boebert got quite a scare, though I think it looks like she's going to hang on in her race. What's interesting to me, though, too, is some of these Democrats that did win, I mean, we have to look at the Democratic campaign committee too, where its own chair got defeated, Sean Patrick Maloney. Also a lesson there, maybe not to Bigfoot another member amidst redistricting and different things. But if some of these people, and if people coming, we're still waiting on California, some of these Republicans that were elected in bluer states, they are striking a more moderate tone. And if the balance is very close, could Democrats even reach out to them to try to bring them on board with things like spending bills and funding the government and debt ceiling and Ukraine aid and different things? So, I mean, he's going to have to work for this, really, to try to get votes. This is not going to be an easy thing.
Right. And let's remember, he was almost Speaker, what, 8-12 years ago, right? And the Freedom Caucus turned against him at the very last moment and elected Paul Ryan Speaker. This election, as several people have said, is really maybe a turning point. We've talked earlier about how it could be a turning point in the Republican Party turning against Trump. Alex, I was impressed by your article for NBC that this election may prove to be a turning point also in the way people accept defeat as opposed to in 2020. As one example, here is Democratic Senate candidate in Ohio, Tim Ryan.
I have the privilege to concede this race to J.D. Vance because the way this country operates is that when you lose an election, you concede.
So, Alex, as you point out, that was true on the Republican and the Democratic side.
Yeah, I mean, that's just classy. I think Tim Ryan had one of the best concessions of the night. And the fact that we're even talking about this is, of course, notable and would be remarkable to anyone living in a different political era, because it was so taken for granted. But I do think it's very reassuring, because after 2020, there was this big question, was this just Trump leading this effort to overturn the 2020 election? Or was he setting a new playbook, a new precedent for how Republicans going forward would deal with any election loss? You know, was this just going to be the new thing that any Republican did? They always cried fraud and fought things, and, you know, there goes elections, basically, was the fear. And so far, at least, it looks like most Republican candidates, including ones who were pretty closely associated with Trump, who won their Republican primaries because Trump endorsed them, including the guy who ran for governor in Maryland, who was at the January 6th rally, mm-hmm. organized buses to go to the January 6th rally, they have all offered quick admissions of defeat. And not only that, but they've been gracious in it. They've, you know, offered prayers and best wishes for the winning candidates. So I think, you know, we're still early. Let's like cross our fingers and knock on wood here. But I think that this does suggest that it was really 2020 was really a top-down thing driven by Trump personally and not by the wider Republican Party. And I think because of that scare, and because there's been all this fear of political violence in the air about elections that don't go our way, people are being extra cautious to concede. And you're hearing things like Tim Ryan, Stacey Abrams, who did not concede her 2018 election, immediately conceded in 2020. So she conceded 2022 before she conceded 2018.
Yeah, right. And Mehmet Oz also in Pennsylvania, right, gave a very graceful concession speech, as I saw. So a change in tone, and maybe another turning point, David, in terms of chaos post-election. I mean, a lot of people were afraid this was going to be, again, multiple lawsuits and challenges and, you know, armed guards showing up at the polling places. For the most part, everything worked pretty smoothly. A couple of glitches in Arizona, which were quickly fixed, but not a lot of problems getting the vote and not a lot of problems counting the vote so far.
So far, yeah. For the most part, I would agree with you. I always thought that the whole election denial and protest was kind of an overrated issue, because most of the people who were threatening to do that weren't going to win or weren't office holders, so they couldn't do anything. If Carrie Lake winds up losing this governor's race, there's not a darn thing she can do about it except sue. So it's really not worth worrying about. I would caveat that, Bill, by saying, though, the Maricopa County, Arizona, had some problems. We've had some problems in Nevada. And I still think this idea that we have to wait so many days to find out who winners are, I think it's very disturbing to a lot of voters. I know, I understand why it is and what mail voting has done to the counting process and all that stuff. But I think it's a problem that's going to be there for a while. I think there are a lot of voters across the country who wonder, why don't we know who won these elections 3 days out?
Mm-hmm. So, Jessica, a final word here before we get to our favorite stories of the week. So where do you think this, to the extent that we know the results so far, how does this position the Democratic Party and the Republican Party moving forward?
Well, I mean, Republicans, if they do get a majority in the House, again, as I mentioned, it's a very narrow one. Does that impact, you know, they sort of had these agendas certainly to push back at the Biden White House. I think we were going to see investigations. We were going to see, inquiries into Hunter Biden and different things. Impeachment. I mean, there were various people I think they could have brought up for impeachment. They certainly, some of the further right people, you heard them talk about, maybe that's not possible anymore, because like I mentioned, they are getting a lot more sort of moderate members in some of these places. So that can impact it. And again, if you have a Senate that is still Democratic, in fact, if Warnock holds on in the runoff, which I agree with David, I think that he has the better chance right now, just looking at all the fundamentals, then they've actually gained a seat. So can they even get a few more things done with, you know, instead of with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. However, I will note, looking ahead to the 2024 map, it is an incredibly difficult one for Democrats that they're going to have to defend people like Manchin and John Tester in Montana and Sherrod Brown in Ohio. They're defending, you know, the majority of the seats, and some of that could get difficult. I mean, Kyrsten Sinema, I think she's going to face a primary challenge. So, you know, 2024 in many regards begins not just for the presidential election, but for that. So you will have divided government still, I think, but it won't be two Republican houses against the presidency. It will at least be another Democrat Republican in the Congress and then the presidency.
Yeah. And President Biden said this week it may make it a little more difficult, but he's still going to charge forward with his agenda. So off we go. A big thank you. Great look back at what we know so far about the results of the midterm elections and where we are today with David Jackson and Jessica Taylor and Alex Seitzwald. Now, before we let you go, we always say there's one story that captures your attention, even in a week like this week, where almost everything was all about the midterm elections. What story stopped you in your tracks this week? David, start us off, please.
Well, after covering the Trump rally in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, which was a less than inspiring experience, I sat down at the hotel bar and watched the final innings of the World Series. I wasn't crazy about the fact that the Houston Astros won because they were caught cheating, stealing signs several years back. But I was ecstatic for their manager, Dusty Baker, 73-year-old Dusty Baker.
Yeah.
Who began his playing career in 1968. He's been managing since 1993. And he was always being bad rap because his teams never performed well in the postseason. Well, they certainly performed well this year, and it was very inspiring and exciting to see him running around, hugging people, giving interviews to everybody, and his face was just a glow. So, you know, Bill, you and I, all us old guys need to stick together, so we all need to be very happy for Dusty Baker, who is now a World Series champion after all these years.
Absolutely, and you know the fact that the Nationals fired Dusty Baker, the biggest mistake they ever made.
Oh, I'm so mad about that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Jessica, how about you? Your favorite story of the week?
So mine is a political one. And when I saw this headline on Twitter the other day, I kind of did a double take. Tillis Cunningham to talk about across the aisle friendship. And this may be a flashback to the North Carolina Senate race last cycle. You know, very bitter race there. One of the highest spent races that Tillis ended up hanging on and winning. Of course, Cal Cunningham had an extramarital affair that came out. But it turns out they gave this talk at UNC last night, and they became friends, like talking at the debates between commercials and different things. And after, you know, I mean, Cunningham, again, graciously conceded, and they started having like dinner and lunch together and different things. And he says, you know, if I want to understand what Democrats are thinking, I call up Cal and all of this. So, you know, they've kind of joked about barbecue. Cunningham had that really bad selfie, you know, where he's just standing in front of a grill and saying it's time for barbecue. And that's not exactly what we call barbecue in the South. Tillis even says he told his campaign like not to harp on that. Just let it play out itself.
Well, I guess maybe a good sign, right?
Yes. So, you know, people, as we're talking about, you know, sort of this maybe comity that's been lost, you know, here are two people, very opposite sides of the political spectrum, had very bitter race, but they came out of it friends. So
yeah, singing Joe Biden's song, more or less, right?
Yes.
Alex Seitzwald, as busy as you were this week, what caught your attention?
Well, the story that has just floored me this week, I think would be getting a lot more attention, except that it coincided exactly with the election, which is the stunning fall of this crypto billionaire, Sam Bankman-Fried.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And who is relevant to everything that we're talking about because he is also a major Democratic donor, mm-hmm. has given tens of millions of dollars and had positioned himself in tons of media profiles, including one that I wrote, to be kind of the next, you know, George Soros or Michael Bloomberg or Tom Steyer. He was going to be a defining feature funder of the Democratic Party. And mm-hmm. Just like literally 4 minutes ago, they just put out a statement saying that his giant crypto trading firm has gone into Chapter 11 bankruptcy and he has resigned as CEO. So and the entire political operation seems to be resigning and shutting down. So this is just a stunning fall. I think there's going to be a lot more to learn about what's going on there. It looks like there was some shady stuff. And Michael Lewis, the fabulous author, he was working on a book about Sam Bankman-Fried before this all started. His book just got way more interesting, and I am very excited to read that when it comes out.
They couldn't have anybody better to write that book than Michael Lewis, by the way. Yeah, but that was a really stunning development. Well, I have to. I want to come back to politics too for my favorite story of the week. And Alex, this sort of builds on your point about the concessions and the change of tone. And I thought this was a great. It's actually a letter to the editor in yesterday morning's New York Times. It's real short. I'm going to read the whole thing. So this. Alice Walker, her name is, writes in, as a recent immigrant to the United States from the UK, I voted for the first time this week. When I reached my polling station at a swimming pool off season, I informed the staff on duty as I didn't really know what to do. "Hey, we got a first time voter," the man said, and the entire place stood up and applauded. She writes, "That moment will stay with me for the rest of my life. Huh. I'd like to thank the good people at the Red Hook Pool for reminding me how beautiful and how powerful democracy can be." Isn't that great? I just thought that was a great feel-good story. Nice. Right. Yeah.
Good for us. I would add a shout out to all the poll workers that worked this election. We've seen clearly over the past few years that is not an easy job. They've been vilified and different things, and these are just people trying to make democracy work. So thank you, poll workers.
Amen to that. Yes. And it did work, and it does work. So, and a big thank you again to Jessica Taylor from Cook Political Report, David Jackson, USA Today, Alex Seitzwald, digital politics reporter for NBC News. Thank you, panelists, and thank you, all good friends, for joining us today for this special post-midterm roundtable on the Bill Press Pod. We'll be back on Tuesday. We'll know a lot more by then. May even know who's won in, hopefully, who's won in Arizona and Nevada. And who's going to be controlling the House? Paul Begala from CNN, great political commentator, one of the best political analysts in the country, will be joining us next Tuesday. So have a great weekend, and we'll see you Tuesday on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.